you.
Hello, I'm Richard Allinson, and this is the Reggae Record Producers, a special edition marking the 30th anniversary of the death of Bob Marley. And we're not featuring just one producer. Over the next hour, we'll concentrate on the arrival of Jamaican music in the UK charts in the late 60s through to British reggae creating major hits in the mid-80s. The producers Sly and Robbie, Dennis Bavell, Chris Porter, and our own Steve Levine will be our guides. And with the help of producer Tony Platt, who engineered Bob Marley's early sessions at Island Records, we'll have a closer listen to some of those groundbreaking recordings. Because it was Bob Marley who introduced the world to the sound of Jamaica. We'll hear how this led to a vibrant British reggae scene and how this music became part of mainstream pop. As a musical form, it's a magpie. It borrows from other genres, taking and adapting what it needs. So whilst Jamaica had its own healthy music scene in the late 50s and the early 60s, it was also absorbing a number of other musical styles, particularly from America, via the radio. This is what Sly Dunbar and Robbie Shakespeare were hearing.
Listen to country and western, calypso, every kind of music, clapper music, chicky, everything. But we love country and western. There's only one radio station, it was Radio Fusion, whatever that station play. You hear calypso, you hear rock and roll, you hear
everything
you can think of.
R&B, BNR, everything.
So, now, I think I'd get a little transistor radio we could have picked up in America and you should like tune into a station and just listen everything from it. It'll be soul, funky, whatever play on that station.
And nothing to do with reggae would be complete without the broadcaster and the reggae historian, David Rodigan.
There was a radio station that Jamaicans listened to called Radio WINZ, which beamed in on AM from New Orleans or somewhere, and that's where they heard this American rhythm and blues. I also remember Gregory Isaacs describing how his mother, when doing the ironing on a Sunday evening, would have a radio rediffusion on a switch in the kitchen. Radio was the key to Jamaicans discovering the music of America. And it was also, when I first went to Jamaica, the key to people hearing music, much more than television. Island-wide, hills and valleys, in the heartland, radio was everything. So you could hear the influence of American rhythm and blues on those early recordings, late 50s, early 60s.
Naturally, Jamaica began building their own radio stations. And in the early days, these served a dual purpose.
RJR was the first station, I believe. Significantly, it was either there or at JBC Radio 1, but probably RJR, that one of the first recordings was ever made. Because I remember Prince Buster telling me how he had used the radio station to record O Carolina. Prince Buster produced that record.
Jamaican record producers in the 60s made use of whatever facilities were available. They also wielded significantly more power than either their British or American counterparts. Othman Muklis is one of the leading publishers of Jamaican music.
In Jamaica, since day one, the producers always had, and to this day had all the power, on a business level and musically. Like, the Jamaican market has always been rhythm-driven. If there's a hot rhythm in Jamaica, everybody wants to be on it. In the early days, the producers were quite severe in their control of the business, where artists would be standing in a long queue outside the gates just waiting to get called into vocal, and they'll get a small amount of cash, which is, they'll never see any royalties after that. But that was how it worked. The producers were all powerful down there.
The record producers who emerged during the 60s might have had tighter business and financial control than those in America and Britain, but that shouldn't detract from the fact that they were also extremely talented. David Rodigan nominates two influential people who helped change the course of Jamaican music. They influenced Bob Marley and those that followed.
Lee Perry and King Tubby were very, very significant players in the history of Jamaican music. They can't be spoken of highly enough. Frankly, Lee Perry was nothing short of a genius. When you consider what he was able to create in his own Black Ark studio, and before that when he was using other people's studios, such as Randy's studio, where he recorded a number of hits. And some of the rhythms that Lee Perry came up with were just bionic. Osborne Ruddock, this man obsessed with electronics and sound. He was quiet and reserved and very chilled. Not at all the image that I would have expected, you know, King Toppy. And he was an electronics genius. He built amplifiers and he repaired anything electrical, he could repair it. He was just gifted. And he built one of the most famous sound systems in the history of Jamaican sound system culture, King Tubby's Hometown Hi-Fi. Apparently you could hear this thing from a 3-mile radius. When he strung that sound system up in Western Kingston, literally hundreds of people would gather. And he was the first one to experiment with the idea of dub. Because, of course, he was also a technician, so he built a sound system, he played out, and he would experiment with acetates, dub plates. They were also known as soft wax.
As a producer, King Tubby found his greatest success from the 70s onwards. But back in the 60s, his early experiments with dub, alongside Lee Scratch Perry's visionary rhythms and production style, inspired new directions for Jamaican music. And there was, of course, the influence of the sounds filtering down from North America, with the 60s productions from Detroit having an obvious effect on the development of reggae. A production trick occasionally used by Motown would be to accentuate the melodic quality of the bass lines by doubling it on another instrument. Think of the brass copying the bass on the intro to Get Ready by The Temptations. Or What Does It Take to Win Your Love by Junior Walker and the All-Stars, with the piano adding some weight to the line. In the Caribbean, they were doing a similar thing. Record producer and founding member of the British group Matumbi, Dennis Bavell.
In Jamaica, for instance, they were great Fats Domino fans, and Ray Charles, and the Drifters, and the Temptations, of course. So anything that they did in America, they would do a similar thing in Jamaica. The bass guitar was followed completely and shadowed by a picking, what we call the picking guitar. It's like a six-string guitar, right? It was in some ways like how cellos follow the viola in orchestral parts, you know, a sort of a second bass, as it were. And I think that that made the bass line cut through on smaller speakers. Quite a lot of reggae songs, you might not remember the title of the song, but you sure as hell could sing the bass part, especially 007, that Desmond Dekker tune. Or a famous one, Harry J. All-Stars, The Liquidator, that doom 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 doom. That same bass line was borrowed where the Staple Singers had a tune that had the same bass line. I think I read somewhere that the person who played the bass on the Staple Singers tune was actually on holiday in Jamaica, heard that riff, and at the end of a session where they were, you know, just jamming around, decided to jam on that line, and the Staple Singers tune came. I think that's the one bass line that reversed the tide, because usually Jamaicans were following what was happening in America, and here was an incident where America's following the Jamaican bass line.
Staple Singers' American number one, I'll Take You There, came 3 years after Liquidator by Harry J. All-Stars. And it's an early indication of how reggae, having soaked up musical influences from elsewhere, was itself an inspiration to other music. Up to this point, Jamaican music was a complete stranger to the British charts, with Millie's hit My Boy Lollipop being an almost singular exception, and that was 1964. But the adoption of ska by the skinhead movement in the late 60s led to a small number of Jamaican tracks becoming big hits in the UK. These included top 10 singles for both Liquidator and Max Romeo's Wet Dream, a top 5 for Return of Django by Lee Scratch Perry's house band The Upsetters, and Desmond Dekker and the Aces became the first Jamaican act to reach number 1 with Israelites. And as the new decade began, Jamaican music continued to produce big UK and European chart singles. But in some cases, the authenticity of the sound heard on those original hits in the late 60s was now being enhanced to make them sound sweeter to the ear of a Western audience. Original Jamaican recordings were brought to England in order for extra instrumentation to be added. So Young, Gifted and Black by Bob and Marcia and the Pioneers' Let Your Yeah Be Yeah were both embellished with string arrangements, something that both technology and certainly finances wouldn't allow back home in the Caribbean. Though not all of the UK hits were treated in this way. In the spring of 1971, a record entered the chart by musicians who'd worked with Lee Perry in the late 60s, Dave Barker and Ansel Collins.
And the magnificent. I'm back, but the shaker was so bold, most thundering, storming, sound of soul.
Double Barrel climbed to number one at the beginning of May 40 years ago and was one of the earliest recordings to feature a young musician and aspiring record producer, Sly Dunbar.
I remember when Ansel Collins came to me at piano and it's that ominous bass line, doo 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 boom boom. And I said, oh, that's wicked. And we went to rehearsal, we were playing in this band called the RH Invincible. And when we rehearsed, everybody leave and Ansel Collins and myself would stay back and rehearse the tune for 1 week straight and then cut the song. And we had to rent a drum set because I didn't own a drum set then. So he was going to cut 4 songs a night. So I played 2. And Winston Granum, another reggae drummer, he played 2. That's where I would think I really got the old break started for me was then at 15, 16 years old. If I'm not mistaken, it was 2-track. We record onto the 2-track and then we go the next day, copy the 2-track to another tape and we dub the piano lead after. Then I think when they went onto the track, they had to copy that tape again to put Dave on it.
I am the magnificent W-O-O-O.
So while some tapes were being flown to England to be enhanced by string and horn arrangements to turn them into hits, the limited equipment in Jamaican studios was equally able to produce records that appealed to an international audience. In the early 70s, record producer Tony Platt was an engineer who worked at Island Studios across the full spectrum of that label's artists, including, as we'll hear shortly, Bob Marley's recordings. Now, while studios in the UK were generally better equipped than those in Jamaica, there were still limitations in their capability.
The skill set that all recording engineers and producers were bringing to the table was based a little bit in DIY, in any case. So the techniques were all about getting the sound from the instrument in the first place and positioning the microphones well. So really the Jamaican studios weren't at any great disadvantage because they had some very skilled people who understood the music and also had the open-mindedness to try things and see whether they worked well and also had the ears to hear whether or not they were actually sounding right and making the value judgments on that. Let's steal it up. I think it's important to get a little perspective on where reggae sat in things and what the reggae, or at least the Jamaican music scene, was contributing at that point in time. There were a lot of artists like Bob Marley who were writing extremely good songs that were being performed by other artists. So you had several of Bob's songs that had already been performed by Johnny Nash and were released in the UK and indeed in the US. So there was a penetration by the artists in terms of songwriting. It was just that at that particular point in time, the kind of music that artists like Bob were playing was a little too rootsy and didn't really fit into, in particular, the radio formats, and most particularly into the American FM radio formats, which were starting to play a lot more rock music.
With Bob Marley and the Wailers signed to Island Records, label boss Chris Blackwell decided to employ a similar approach to the one that provided hits for Bob and Marcia and the Pioneers. He gave Marley the money to record his first LP for Island, Catch a Fire, in Jamaica. But when the tapes came over to England, rather than add orchestral or horn embellishments, Chris, along with Tony Platt, looked to the rock fraternity. So the recordings of Bob Marley, Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer, along with the rhythm section of drummer Carlton Barrett and his brother, Aston Family Man Barrett, on bass, were enhanced by overdubs from the American rock guitarist Wayne Perkins and the Texan keyboard player John Rabbit Bundrick. Tony Platt joined Steve Levine in his studio to talk about those sessions and, in particular, the track Concrete Jungle.
Let's have a look at the original eight tracks that came over from Jamaica.
Okay, basically the original eight tracks were the drums, the bass, and uniquely the drums were all on one track and the bass was on a separate track. First of all, the practice of putting all the drums on one track was the normal way when you were working with a limited track count. Adding the reverb in on the snare drum was a completely normal thing, and especially if you'd included the bass drum in the one-track mix of the drums, because if you put reverb on afterwards, you'd be putting reverb onto the bass drum as well as the snare drum. I think that that particular sound on the snare drum is important because you've also got to remember that dub reggae was very much part of the roots reggae scene. So some of the sounds that were being used in dub would find their way into the mainstream roots reggae and vice versa. And of course, this is one of the things that sets Bob's music apart, is that it was very much more part of the whole Jamaican music scene rather than just one part of it.
With the drums being on a single track, there's no extra depth, and yet that comes from this acoustic guitar track that's got loads and loads of room bleed. When you put the two together, you get this much, much bigger sound.
The technique of using the room sound to enhance the other instruments was one that was pretty much used on any musical genre back in those days. If you've got all the musicians in one room at the same time, then you're going to get each instrument bleeding onto the microphones from the other instruments. And I think if we moved on to the bass, you'd also be able to hear that the bass sound isn't particularly good on the bass track itself.
And is that DI?
I think that was probably DI. It wasn't always DI, but bass players in reggae bands quite often had speakers that were far too large to get into the studio anyway, so it's more likely that it was DI. But when you put all of the other tracks in, you suddenly realise that there is bass spillage on pretty much all of the tracks, especially the drums. And once you get that very low-end bass spillage coming in and adding to the sound of the bass DI on the main bass track, that elasticity that's so very, very important to reggae bass sounds starts to come through. And of course, we also put the clavinet on, and the clavinet is playing a certain amount of the bass line as well.
In fact, let's highlight the clavinet, because this was one of the subsequent overdubs done in London. And at the time, a clavinet was still a relatively new instrument.
Yes, it may be that this was around the time that clavinet was first being used on reggae music. It certainly took off, and from that point, it's become very much part of reggae music.
So apart from the clavinet, another important instrument on this multitrack is the organ.
Yes, the paddle on the organ is very, very important, and very few musicians I've come across can actually make that work properly. Because again, it's down to the rhythmic feel of that, and it bubbles away underneath. It creates more atmosphere than anything else, but it definitely contributes to the rhythm as well.
So apart from the keyboards, there's quite a lot of extra guitars. There's two tracks here. There's one that's kind of labelled lead and harmony, and then this other one labelled lead.
Yes, well, this was Wayne Perkins, a very, very well-known slide guitar player. He basically just laid down ideas. But on this particular track, when we went to do a harmony, we first of all laid down a main lead guitar, and then he said he'd put some harmonies on there. And when I started the tape up to record the harmonies, I just dropped it straight into record. And he just played a little line on the front. And then when we came to mix it, we said, well, that's fantastic. So we just lifted a little bit of that line and used it on the very, very beginning of the track. And you can hear that on the final record. And it sort of sets the atmosphere for what's about to happen in the rest of the tune.
Now, it's only right and proper that we listen to the vocals. Shall we listen first to Bob's original vocal that was recorded in Jamaica?
No sun will shine in my day today.
Yes, it's interesting that quite a few of the vocals on the original tapes were a little bit distorted, and some of the performances were perhaps just a little lackluster. And there were some of the lyrics that subsequently were changed.
Darkness has covered my light,
and has changed.
Whoa.
One of the challenges for me was to make sure that the vocal sound that I got in the studio in London was going to fit the rawness of the basic track that came from Jamaica. So I had to be careful not to record it too nicely.
Where the living is hardest. Concrete jungle. Man.
The earliest recordings of Concrete Jungle date back to 1971, but the song that became the opening track on the 1973 album Catch a Fire was recorded around October 72 at Dynamic Studios and then brought to England, where mix engineers Tony Platt and Stu Barrett recorded those additional keyboards and guitar. The album showcased the socially aware lyrical content of Bob Marley's songs. The remix music, though failing to set the charts alight, moved the Wailers into a more commercial market. But Chris Blackwell did this differently to the way other artists were treated at the time. Marley provided, for want of a better term, a rock equivalent to the more mainstream, smoother sound of reggae, as typified by Johnny Nash, the Pioneers, and the soon-to-emerge Ken Booth, with his number one version of the David Gates song, Everything I Own. Reggae arguably became more mainstream when it looked further than its own Jamaican roots in terms of the songs available to the artists. A savvy A&R exec could see potential in taking a pop hit such as Crispin St. Peter's Pied Piper or Bread's Everything I Own and producing reggae versions for Bob and Marcia or Ken Booth. In reverse, the commercial success possible through a cross-pollination of musical styles is typified by Eric Clapton's 1974 American number one version of Bob Marley's song, I Shot the Sheriff. While there is this trade-off of songs between reggae and pop and back again, there's also the fact that within reggae itself, the song is open to different interpretations. Johnny Nash had a hit in 1972 with Bob Marley's Stir It Up, a song Bob first recorded way back in 67. The version that made it onto the Catch a Fire album was recorded just a few months after Johnny Nash had the hit and has a very different feel. And this was yet another of our exclusive multitracks Tony Platt and Steve Levine played back in the studio.
So guide me through the original tracks that came from Jamaica, because again, this was a transfer from an original 8-track.
Well, yes, I think it's important to point out that Stir It Up is the link between the reggae that people knew about, because they will have first heard Stir It Up performed by Johnny Nash in a much more poppy version. And therefore, we didn't necessarily need to take that so much towards the rock genre. And so we were able with that to just take them into the type of reggae that Bob was doing and contrasting that from the style of reggae that they'd heard this particular song in before.
The drums are recorded on two tracks on this multi-track.
Yes, the recording of the drums would have been a choice that the engineer made. With this particular song, the beat that the bass drum is on is very, very important, and therefore getting that to be at the right level in the mix was very important. Having the bass drum on a separate track on this one was absolutely essential. And it's notable that unlike the previous track that we listened to, where there is reverb on the snare, he didn't have to put the reverb on the snare on this one because he hadn't mixed the bass drum in on the same track. The other tracks that came over on the multi-track with this particular one were a piano and guitar track, which was a picking guitar that picks along with the bass line, and a piano in the background. Now, this actually, we took that out and replaced the picking guitar because we didn't want the piano. I think the main reason that the doubling of the bass with the pick guitar is so effective is that so much of the important role of the bass line in reggae is to enhance the melody. And if you've got a melody like this, it's nice to be able to enhance that and pick it out with an instrument that is closer to the same octave that the vocal is singing in.
And on the subject of guitars, you've got the picking guitar doubling the bass to enhance that element of it, but then you've got the skank guitar, which emphasizes the beat. And in fact, the entire track starts with that, doesn't it?
The skank guitar is extremely important in this, and it's probably it's the trademark that everybody recognizes this particular song from, because the song starts off with that, with just the Moog synthesizer waffling away underneath it.
So that's the core of the elements that came over from Jamaica. But once again, some very, very important additions were made. So the clavinet was added on this occasion with wah-wah, but only from the halfway point.
The clavinet was really added on this track more as a solo instrument. It comes in the middle section and plays its own solo line.
Now, there's also the additional electric guitar from Wayne on here. There's two tracks. One track is a sort of general lead track, and then there's another track that just comes in the middle.
Yes. I think this was probably a little bit later in the whole proceeding of overdubbing, and Wayne was getting a bit more familiar with it. And I was getting more familiar with how Wayne's sounds were fitting in to the tone of the whole tune and the whole album. It contrasts very nicely with the angular rhythms of the reggae, and it slips and slides in and out of all the other rhythms. So I think it was a very, very inspired idea to bring musicians like this into the music.
And finally, let's have a look at the vocals. Now, on this, the lead vocal is the original recording that was made in Jamaica, a single track of Bob's lead vocal, but it also has the reverb printed.
Yes, it was. This was a very good performance, and again, it wasn't unusual when recording with limited track counts to print the reverb.
Little darling, steer it up.
The studios had limited resources, so they may have only had one reverb device in the whole studio, and as he didn't print it on the snare drum, he's put it on the vocal, knowing that when he went back to the mix, he was going to have to use the reverb on the snare drum.
There's also a harmony track that's been added to Bob. So what most people are aware of on this vocal is actually the vocal is in two part.
Yes, we recorded the harmony in London. It was Bob's idea to try it on top. Of course, what it does do, because the vocal recorded in Jamaica with the reverb on it had a tendency to be a little more hollow because the reverb was on there, having the harmony there as well made it much easier for me to give the vocal a solid sound and position it in the mix in a prominent enough position.
Come on and steer it up, yeah, little darling, steer it up.
And it's actually a very warm tone. It does sound like he's quite close to the mic and he's not giving it much energy. But as you say, combined with the lead vocal, he's creating a composite, very, very warm, rich sound.
I think Bob's vocal style was very much that slightly laid back. It's, you know, in any other musical genre, it's a bit like a Sinatra delivery, really. It makes you feel very comfortable. It's, as you say, it's very warm, very liquid sounding. It makes you listen to the lyrics. This is all part of the package that is Bob Marley.
And the other part of this record are the backing vocals.
Little darling, steer it up.
So let's isolate the Jamaican lead vocal, the harmony, and the two backing vocal tracks.
It was very much the norm in those days for singers and the rest of a band to go and work out a few parts and then lay those down for backing vocals. And I think that's exactly what's happened here.
Come and cool me down, baby, when I'm hot. Your recipe, darling, is so tasty. And you sure can steer your part, so steer it.
It means that the backing vocals have easily as much character as the lead vocal. That imparts a whole different feel to the overall effect.
Now, I think you're absolutely right. Had they had a greater track count, they would have potentially recorded the singers individually, as is more common today, whereas they were forced to do it all around one mic and get that internal balance. And you're absolutely right. Not only does it have an interesting balance within the harmonies, but it has a very interesting dynamic. And because they would sing all the way through rather than copy one section to another section, the song has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
I agree completely that because they didn't have the facility of cutting and pasting one chorus into all the other choruses, that you get a different dynamic and the character of the backing vocals change as the song goes through.
Stir It Up and its parent album Catch a Fire lay the foundation for Marley's future sound. Chris Blackwell's approach at Island brought a new view to reggae that retained its credibility but brought commercial appeal. Although this was criticized by some reggae purists, it set a new and different template for reggae outside of Jamaica. Tony Platt.
I think it's worth pointing out the whole aspect of reggae music and its position in the music industry in general that was opened up by what Chris did with those records and what he did at Island. It paved the way for bands like Black Uhuru to come along and take reggae music into all sorts of other exploratory places.
Whilst artists might have benefited from the Island Records approach, there were also those musicians who were beginning to make a name for themselves as producers. For example, Sly and Robbie were looking further afield from their Jamaican base for their influences. Their second home in the mid-70s was Channel One Studios in West Kingston. Sly Dunbar.
We were aiming at the Philly sound, and we tried to get it as close as we could get. So we used to listen to all the stuff they used to do on Salsoul also. We used to backtrack all the recording of Philly that the MFSB were involved in, Earl Young and all these people. So we'd shape the Channel One sound. We never get entirely as exact, but we know it sounded as good. So this is what we use to copy, and then I start. It was a much cleaner sound of Motown. Yeah, sometimes they would play, and it was really groovy, you know?
A trademark sound of the Philadelphia soul music was the open cymbal of the hi-hat, something that both appealed to Sly, but was also already prevalent in Jamaican music.
When I first heard The Love I Lost, I see it in Jamaica record before that, in the ska. Because there was a record called Moonlight Lover, that was actually, but I heard it in that record first time I heard that open cymbal. But in the ska, they used to play ting, tick, 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 ching, and then moonlight drop. And so one day I went back and played it in Double Barrel in 1969. So the Love I Lost came after that. So that mean Tom Bell probably was the one who introduced them to that open cymbal, because he's Jamaican and he knew where that was coming from ska.
Late 60s, that's Moonlight Lover by Joy Landis, a track that highlights that open cymbal sound adopted by the Sound of Philadelphia, which in turn informed the production style of Sly and Robbie in the mid-70s. At that same time in the UK, a new generation of groups had started to form. Spearheaded by Aswad and Steel Pulse, British reggae began to find its own voice. Aswad's self-titled debut album was released in 1976 on the island subsidiary Mango. The Bob Marley influence could clearly be heard on that album's opening track, but they brought a new approach to the music. Here's Tony Platt.
Aswad were, in those days, a very interesting band because they decided that they quite liked the idea of the dub, and they decided that what they were going to do was to play dub rather than actually leave it to the chance of the mix. And so their first album and the way they first went out on the road was quite unique in their own style. I was very pleased that there was this young, basically British reggae band that had taken the pioneering spirit that Bob had shown and were pushing the boundaries of the genre much further.
Whilst British reggae was forging ahead in the late 70s with bands such as Matumbi, Steel Pulse and Aswad, the music was also jumping genre and infiltrating other styles. Yes, there was the reggae light of Typically Tropical's Barbados, Reggae Like It Used To Be by Paul Nicholas, Dreadlock Holiday by 10cc, but the new rebellious sound of punk was beginning to emerge. Its roots were as underground as those of reggae. At its most intelligent, as in the case of The Clash, its subject matter dealt with social issues that mirrored those found in Bob Marley's lyrics. The band's first album included their version of the Junior Mervyn song, Police and Thieves, whilst their 1978 single, White Man in Hammersmith Palais, successfully merged a reggae rhythm with a rock beat. Over the course of their albums, The Clash continually referenced reggae and dub in their music. But in terms of integrating reggae's rhythm and style, no rock band did it as successfully on a commercial level as The Police. By the late 1970s, not only had reggae found a regular place in the charts, it had now crossed over into punk, pop and rock, and paved the way for a ska revival through Two Tone. Whilst bands like The Specials, Madness and Selector wrote and recorded original material, they also introduced both songs and artists from the original ska and bluebeat days to a new generation. A prime example is A Message to You, Rudy, because not only was it a cover of Dandy Livingston's 1967 rocksteady song Rudy, A Message to You, it also featured the Jamaican trombonist Rico Rodriguez, who played on the original. 70s had seen chart success for the softer sound of reggae through artists such as Johnny Nash and Ken Booth. The more rock-oriented sound of Bob Marley had established him as a star. The music had been covered by artists as diverse as Clapton and The Clash. Dub even made its way into the mainstream charts, courtesy of Rupi Edwards, and a new generation had been introduced to the roots of the music through the two-tone movement. But although homegrown talent was critically acclaimed, and bands such as Steel Pulse debuted on the album chart, there hadn't been a truly massive hit by a UK reggae artist. That is, until producer Dennis Bavell wrote and produced a single for a girl from North London.
Reggae had been the sound of protest, and it also had been the sound of love with Love of the Common People. Nicky Thomas had done this song, and Susan Beware of the Devil, Dandy Livingstone. But now, for the first time, there would be a black British female vocalist that was going to enter the arena. Millie Small had been there before, but she was Jamaican, right? Janet Kay was born in Wembley. And there we were having our own unique style of reggae, British style of reggae, that we then called Lover's Rock. I had the idea that this is the kind of reggae tune that someone like Minnie Riperton would make, with that really high note in there. It was whilst working with Sly Dunbar and Lloyd Parks on a track with Janet Cade. She'd done a version with Sly and Lloyd of That's What Friends Are For, Denise Williams, a reggae version of that, you know, and at the end of that, it had that really high part. And she sang that so beautifully, I thought, this is the singer for my tune. And when I sang her, she said, what? You can do that? I must be able to do that. And she scaled it admirably.
Single to stop that song getting to number one was Tubeway Army's Our Friends Electric. Janet Kay's Silly Game spent 2 weeks at number two in the summer of 1979, and in our extended version on BBC Six Music later this month, we'll have exclusive access to the multi-track of that song. As the 1980s began, British reggae continued to flourish with a top 10 single for Black Slate with Amigo and the debut chart appearances from UB40. Internationally, Sly and Robbie were achieving huge acclaim with their work with Black Uhuru, and the untimely loss of Bob Marley in 1981 only served to raise reggae's profile even higher. In Britain, the amalgamation of reggae with pop that had begun with The Clash, The Police and others was taken to another level with a new young band, Culture Club. Here's Boy George.
When I was a punk at 16, I worked for a guy called Troy in the King's Road in the Chelsea Antiques Market. And one day, this man came into the store, and Troy was really going on about this guy, Bob Marley. I had no idea who he was, but I remember this guy coming down the kind of corridor, big locks, big sort of like sunglasses, denim shirt. Something about him, there was something about this man that was kind of special, but I had no idea who he was. And funny enough, actually, Troy asked me if my mum would dye 7 white boiler suits, khaki green, and sew these little red, gold and green kind of badges on the sleeves and the front. So I took these bloody boiler suits home to my mum in Woolwich and ruined her washing machine by dyeing them green and got her to sew these things. And then I was actually invited to the gig at the Rainbow Theatre, but I didn't go, I was too scared. Because back then, you know, well, I was a punk anyway, and I knew I would have sort of stood out at a Marley gig. And that's kind of how I then went on to kind of buy some of his records and start to explore him as a kind of artist. I've always said that reggae, in some respects, is closest to punk than any kind of music, because, especially ragga music, because it's just wrong, a lot of it. It's like, how, this isn't right, but it is. It works, you know. When you first hear reggae, it's kind of offbeat, like you're falling over. So it's absolutely different. And of course, it's impure as well, because a lot of pop music in the 70s was really uber-produced, big harmonies, wall of sound. And reggae was kind of a little bit off. Some of the vocals were totally out of tune, you know. The bass lines were out of tune with the vocals, you know. Some of the instrumentation was wrong, but it didn't matter.
Bassist Mikey Craig grew up in a West London home that would often house huge sound systems. The combination of his parents' blues parties and a visit to Jamaica when he was young gave him both a love and appreciation of reggae, with Marley being just one of the artists he admired.
The first time I was properly aware of Bob Marley was after the release of Catch a Fire, particularly the track Concrete Jungle, which just had such a melodic bass line. Obviously, Family Man must have been hearing a lot of Motown R&B and so on and so forth. It's got such a melodic bounce about it, and it's also about what he doesn't play as well as what he plays. There are nice little gaps in there, which are lovely. And that was the first bass line that really knocked me for six.
As a young British man of Jamaican heritage, Mikey was also very in tune with the homegrown talent.
With the explosion of UK reggae, there was Steel Pulse, there was another band called Black Slate, there was another band called Tradition as well. They were bringing forward this an English style of reggae, which was essentially, it was Jamaican, but I mean, it had a UK flavor as well. It was almost like another separate genre by itself, but it was very successful. And in particularly Steel Pulse, who were really, really top ranking band.
Boy George.
I was always drawn to the kind of lovers rock reggae. That's my first introduction to reggae. I got into some of the Righteous stuff later on, but initially it was just great songs, you know, and I was always about great songs, whether it was a Sonny and Cher record or a reggae record. It wasn't about necessarily what type of music it was, because when I was sort of 11, 12, 13, to me, all music was amazing. And I would give anything I own, give up my life, my heart, my own. And I would give anything I own just to have you back again.
As a group, Culture Club melded all those childhood influences into a string of hits in the early 80s, beginning with a number one that was an unmistakable fusion of reggae and pop. Its producer is our own Steve Levine, and Steve, this is the time, the first time in the history of this program, we're going to listen to one of your productions in depth, and you're going to have to remind yourself of what you were doing, what, very nearly 30 years ago.
Yeah, it was around May 82, and it was fascinating to get the tapes back from EMI Virgin and put them on and listen to them, because I hadn't listened to them since the day that we did the final mix.
And those songs are still played on the radio. Does it still take you back to those sessions when you hear the songs?
Well, when I hear the song on the radio, it reminds me of the sessions. But listening to the multi-track and being able to analyse them with such great detail, it really reminds me of very specific things in the session. So if we play the lead vocal, for example, it immediately has the sound of Redbus Recording Studio's Corridor, which is where we recorded the actual lead vocal.
Why didn't you put him in the studio? Why did you put him in the corridor?
That studio didn't have a vocal isolation booth. So John Moss, the drummer, along with Roy Hay on guitar and Mikey Craig on bass, sat in the recording area of the studio. I sat in the control room. And in order to have the separation, the only spare place for George was in the corridor that linked the two together.
Okay. So you got George's lead vocal here, right?
Yes.
Give me time to realize my crime. Let me love and steal. I have danced.
What's so amazing, and it's really worth remembering, is that this vocal was one single take from the beginning of the song to the very end, with no stops, no drop-ins. That is it.
Is that the first one he did?
It was the second or third run-through of the song, but this is the one and only time that he completed that vocal like that.
Okay.
Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry? Precious kisses, words that bind me. Lovers never ask you why.
It sounds quite metallic. That's the sound of the corridor, isn't it?
The corridor was quite narrow and it had a very big piece of glass so that if you were in the control room, you could see both the corridor and the recording studio.
So why doesn't it sound like that on the record then?
On the final mix, I added artificial reverb and I added tape delay. Because this is a reggae song, most reggae lead vocals have a hint of tape delay and I added those sounds to it. So if I give you an example, here's the dry vocal.
Right. Do you really want to make me cry?
Here's the reverb.
Do you really want to hurt me?
And now here's the tape
play. Do you really want to make me cry?
And this is the kind of thing that I added on the final mix.
Do you really want to hurt me?
As just an indication of reggae's influence on British music by this time, Do You Really Want to Hurt Me had replaced Musical Youth's Pass the Dutchie at number one and brought reggae another new audience. Yes, the music had instant appeal with the record-buying public, but Boy George's image also attracted the poster pin-up readers of smash hits to Culture Club and arguably introduced a generation of teenagers to reggae. Here was an 80s pop band creating huge commercial hit songs that had strong Jamaican musical influences. So could an established British reggae group successfully do the opposite, cross over into mainstream pop? Step forward Aswad and producer Chris Porter.
My involvement was to try and get them a hit, really, and that it was as simple as that. I thought I knew an awful lot about reggae at the time, and because the enthusiasm of youth and the ignorance of youth, you kind of think, well, that's fine, I know about reggae, you know, I grew up with it. I know about ska, I know about Blue Beat, and I've listened to Bob Marley. But in actual fact, you've discovered that you don't know very much at all, which in a way was a good thing, because I approached it as if it was just a pop record. The thing that I thought when I first heard them was that Brinsley had such an authentic reggae voice. He sounded like Bob Marley. And when we came to actually look at Don't Turn Around, Drummy sang it to me first, and Drummy's got a completely different kind of voice. It's very soft and mellifluous, and I thought immediately very, very commercial. But I had to break this to the band, and I deliberated about it for some hours, sort of thinking, how is it going to be possible to take the singing role away from the singer on what could be an important record for them?
I suggested that Drummy sing it, and I suggested just I'd like to hear him sing it. It didn't go down very well with Brinsley, but that was really the starting point of that record, because it made a complete difference to the sound of the record. The lyric became much softer, much gentler, more comprehensible. And it's kind of a bit like, if you think of the way that black music was adapted by Presley in the 50s and became acceptable. This was a kind of a way of putting this acceptable, much whiter voice, if you like, in front of Aswad, which they hadn't had before. I don't think Drummy had sung seriously before on the records. And it made it a completely different kind of record, made it much more commercial. It wasn't really a reggae record, I don't think. And certainly their fans didn't think it was a reggae record. But it was a crossover record. And at the time, crossover records were very, very important.
Life as a rock song, but Aswad's reggae version of Don't Turn Around got to number one in 1988, and it wraps up this edition of The Record Producers. Now, the path we've taken is just a small one in terms of the development and influence of reggae music, but we'll expand on this in our extended programme on BBC Six Music on Saturday, May 14th, where we'll take a closer look at dub music and the influence in the late 1970s of reggae on punk, alongside a much more in-depth listen to Culture Club's multi-track of Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, and that exclusive multi-track recording of Silly Games by Janet Kay. You can listen again at bbc.co.uk/radio2. I'm Richard Allinson. The Record Producers was devised by Steve Levine, written and produced by Neil Miners, and is a magnum opus broadcasting production for BBC Radio 2.
And this is BBC Radio 2, online, on digital, and on 88 to 91 FM.